So this evening is the last then in a short series on the life to come, called Without End. Last time we looked at hell. This evening then we come to the much easier topic to handle of heaven. Easier, that is, emotionally, though not necessarily, if you like, intellectually, because it's a difficult subject to get our heads around, the topic of heaven. So I want you to imagine that you're going to describe a day in your life, just an everyday in your life, but you're going to do this to somebody from the 17th century. You might like to think of your favourite Puritan, you know, John Owen, Thomas Goodwin, Richard Sibbes, whoever it is, your favourite Puritan. You describe to this person a day in your life. So you say, well, you know, typically, you know, the alarm clock goes off at about 6:30 in the morning, the radio comes on and I get up, and then, of course, you know, Dr. Sibbes says, well, sorry, a what? A radio? A what? An alarm clock? What, you know, and you suddenly realise that you've got big problems trying to describe what you take for granted every day, because you think, oh, wow, of course, they hadn't even discovered or invented electricity. They hadn't discovered electromagnetic radiation back then. And then you think ahead and you think about flushing toilets and electric lights and kettles, and you drive to work and combustion engines and all this technology, and we take it all for granted. And you haven't even got to mobile phones, smartphones, internet, computers. How do you describe this then to dear old Dr. Sibbes back there? And it's like that, I think, with the Lord to teach us about heaven. Heaven, I think, will be full of wonderful, wonderful experiences, a reality with dimensions beyond what we can now understand. Like us trying to explain to somebody centuries ago about a day in our life, the Lord has to try to reach down and describe the immense wonders that he's got stored up for us in heaven in language that we can make some sense of. And so as we do that, I think that whatever I try to teach you and unfold this evening from the scriptures is really only going to be a small part of. I suspect it'll be a very small part of the wonders that the Lord has stored up for us there. But it isn't completely impossible to talk to people in earlier centuries. We could talk about ourselves, and Dr. Sibbes would be able to understand our relationships in our church. We could talk about our worship in the service, couldn't we? We could talk about our husbands, wives, children, and so on. We could communicate such things. And that's why I think that much of what we do have then in the scriptures is to do with humans and relationships, and of course with God himself and with worship. Because these are commonalities that down the ages we can all understand. They're all true of heaven, but I think they're everything that will be there in heaven. That's kind of caveat, if you like, to start with. But then as we come then to focus on heaven, I'd like to think of it as a large picture, or me trying to draw a large picture. But then think of this as a jigsaw puzzle, a very large jigsaw puzzle. And if you've got this great pile of jigsaw pieces, then the first thing that you do is you rummage around and you try to find all the straight bits that are going to form the edges so you can get the outline of the jigsaw. And so I just want to quickly go through four truths to start with, which are like the solid outline, or what we definitely know about heaven. Four solid truths, and then to move to four images that we're given of heaven, by which we'll try and fill in, if you like, the rest of the picture. And these images are necessarily then going to be more speculative, and you may feel at times I'm going a bit off-piste, but I think we should try and reflect on the meaning then of the images, but within then what we know to be true. And I'll try, I hope I will, stay within biblical parameters. But we then have four solid truths and then four pictures, which are biblical images. And we reflect on what they mean for us and teach us about heaven. So first of all then, four basic truths. Firstly then, heaven is forever. Heaven is forever. We saw that we were made to be everlasting creatures, to live in communion with God. That was created. That's how we were created to be. that's a fundamental, and I'm sure there's no dispute that heaven and our life then with God is everlasting. It's forever. Secondly, heaven is free of sin and all its baleful effects in the curse, isn't it? Again, I don't think there'll be any dispute. This is fundamental. We read a text there at the beginning of Revelation saying as much, didn't we? Revelation 21, God himself will be there as their God, and he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall be mourning or crying nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. That's one of these wonderful things that we look forward to, be free from aging, free from sickness and pain and sleeplessness and all of that that makes life in a grumbling, miserable way tricky in this world. And then thirdly, heaven is on earth. Heaven is a physical place. Heaven is solid and substantial. It has placeness. It has time. It has these dimensions. Because as we've read in Romans 8, it is a continuation of this earth. As Peter says, purified as by fire in a crucible. It comes out as the purified from sin and the effects of sin in the curse as a new creation. We know this is so too from the fact of our resurrection bodies, don't we? The resurrection bodies, Jesus himself first, then all of us when he returns, these are physical bodies. We will return then to being perfect, psychosomatic, whole beings in which we will serve God forever and ever. Heaven isn't a vague, nebulous, floating around kind of place. Heaven is solid. Heaven is substantial. Heaven is ultimately here on renewed earth in our resurrection bodies. And there's this continuity that Paul emphasizes in 1 Corinthians 15 and the resurrection body that Paul picks up again then in Romans 8, isn't there? The continuity of the world, this earth and so on, the continuity of ourselves. Sometimes people ask a question which I find rather peculiar and say, well, will we know each other in heaven? It's a sort of odd question, I think. Of course we'll know each other in heaven. There's continuity between us now and who we will be there. We have it explicit, as I say, in the continuity of the body. But if I don't know you, I don't know how I would know myself. I don't know how anybody would know anything. We don't enter heaven as blank slates. We don't have our memory banks wiped clean in our resurrection body. What we've learned here on earth and so on will be with us, because otherwise you wouldn't be the you I know. You wouldn't have the skills and the personality structure that I know you to be and you know me to be. So we will be there in resurrection body. We will be there in a physical place. So heaven is forever. Heaven is, of course, free of sin and the curse. Heaven is a physical place. It's here on earth. And fourthly, then, heaven is, of course, being with God in Christ. Again, I don't think anybody would dispute it. It's the essence of heaven, is being with God face to face at last. As we've sung earlier, John says in 1 John 3, verse 2, doesn't he? Beloved, we are God's children now, and what we will be has not yet appeared, but we know that when he appears, we'll be like him. When he returns, we'll be like him. We shall see him as he is. And we read similarly in Revelation 21, didn't we? Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man, and he will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and he will be his God. And that culmination of all those covenant promises repeated down the ages will be there at last, consummated in glory, when we see him face to face. Here then, like those psalmists, we have that longing, don't we, to be with him. Psalm 27, for example, he cries out, one thing have I asked of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. And there at last in heaven it will be so. Psalm 73, whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. So we long to be with the Lord face to face at last and enjoy him. And of course, this is what we will experience at last forever in heaven, free from sin and the curse, in heaven at last, here established on earth. So four, I think, solid truths. But then let us move to reflect on four images that were given of heaven. So firstly then, heaven is pictured for us as a place of worship. You might say, well, that sounds like another solid outline, doesn't it? It's hardly disputable that we will be worshipping God in heaven. But I've put it in here partly to reflect on it a little more, but also because sometimes perhaps people think that all we will be doing in heaven is kind of falling down on our faces and praising God. That heaven is a place of forever and ever falling down in worship or something. But we weren't created simply to be in congregational worship, falling down on our face all the time. That's part of what will be in heaven. But in the Garden of Eden, Adam was told to work, and so there's more to serving God in heaven than even worship, as formal worship like we're doing this evening, which is of course an anticipation of that in heaven. In fact, that's what we read of in Hebrews 12, isn't it? The writer says, you know, you've come to Mount Zion as they gather in worship. You've come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. So yes, in Revelation we have then the culmination, we have these pictures in Revelation 5 and so on of a great gathering of men and women, now at last righteous and perfect, gathering in worship around the throne of God with multitudes of angels and so on. We sang of that earlier on. And what kind of worship will it be? Will it be a kind of enormous expansion of a Newcastle Reformed Evangelical Church service of worship where we all sing from Christian hymns and so on? No, I don't think so. Whilst I think that we worship in a biblical way, I don't think there's only one biblical way of worshipping God as a worshipping congregation. I think that in heaven there will be then variation in our worship. I struggle to know whether we will always be one huge congregation in heaven. We know it'll be a great multitude that no man can count or number worshipping God. And maybe it's one of those things that will be revealed there that we can't now understand. I struggle to know how we will hear anything in such a noise of praise. How we will see Jesus if there's such a multitude, because won't we be too far away and so on. And we are physical still. And so I wonder often then whether we will have lots of smaller congregations gathering. But I think whether we're small or one large congregation, I think we will worship in different ways. That there will be some Genevan Calvinistic worship. There will be some 7th century Eastern Orthodox worship. That there may be, that will be Pentecostal, African type worship. There will be Newcastle Reformed type, which I think there will be drawing from what is good and right in all these different ways of worshipping God, all brought together, perfected in heaven. And yes, we will see Jesus there, and not just from afar. Yes, there will be huge numbers of us, a multitude no man can count or number, but then we've got a very long time. We've got forever. And that's long enough, isn't it, for Jesus to come and meet you face to face, to come and shake your hand and say, well done, good and faithful servant. To say to you, well done, Bethan, for serving me so strongly and faithfully through such illness. Well done, Eric Little, for giving up the glory of this world to go and serve me with such suffering in China. And so on. There will be then these individual thanks to all of us for our service of the Lord here on earth. Face to face, we will see him from time to time in glory. We will worship him there. We will see him there individually, personally, and I think we will worship in all sorts of varied ways. Then the second image of heaven is it's a place of work. Now, I suppose it's not often if you say to people, what's heaven like? You're going to say it's a place of work. But of course, we mean work not just in the way of paid employment. We mean work in using the talents that the Lord has given us, things that we enjoy doing in his service every day, not at all necessarily what we're paid to do. It includes that. And of course, we go back and remind ourselves in the Garden of Eden, working and serving the Lord in that way was part of what we were created to do. And I think, as I said, that as we enter heaven, then we carry forwards with us then our own personalities, with our knowledge, all the skills that we've learned that are part of what makes you, you, and me, me. And we will continue to express ourselves through using that knowledge and experience in heaven. And remember that the images that we have of, well, not images, but the language Paul uses of the resurrection and the transformation of the earth are languages of continuity, but they're of development, aren't they? That here our body is just like a seed. There's a continuity, but then something marvellous, something much greater comes in what grows from that. It's continuous, and yet it's hugely improved. Or it's like this, the earth, as it were, is this newborn baby. The mother's groaning and it comes forth. But again, it's living, dynamic language, isn't it? Heaven isn't a static place. Heaven isn't a no-change environment. Heaven is a place of growth and development in our service of the Lord. I think that's what the verses at the end of Revelation 21 are about, when we read in verses 24 and 26 of these kings of the earth bringing in the wealth of the nations. By its light, verse 24, will the nations walk, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it. Verse 26, they'll bring into it the glory and honour of the nations. Now, some of you know as much of Revelation is drawn from prophecies in the Old Testament and a lot from Isaiah. This is language drawn from Isaiah, and in particular here, chapter 60. In Isaiah 60, we read, the nations shall come to your light and the kings to the brightness of your rising. Then you shall see and be radiant. Your heart shall thrill and exult because of the abundance of the sea shall be turned to you. The wealth of the nations shall come to you. Your gates shall be open continually. Day and night they shall not be shut, that people may bring to you the wealth of the nations with their kings led in procession. That's what John is drawing on. And the kings there are people from the Gentile nations of the earth coming to join Israel in the worship of God. The kings are you and me, Christian men and women from the nations coming to worship God because we're kings who reign with him. And we bring then these treasures, the wealth of the nations, to him. And of course, when Jesus spoke of storing up treasures in heaven, he didn't mean literal gold or diamonds and things. I'm sure such stuff will be there. But his focus was metaphorical. It was on the service that we do for the Lord now. How we express our love through obedience and diligence in his service now. And the more we love him now, as I've said before, the more we grow in him now, the more we carry forth now into heaven, the more service we've given him now, the more devotion we've shown him now, the greater our capacity will be to serve him and love him in heaven. And we will take then all this that we've served him with now with us into heaven. And I think technologies will come through as well. I think what is good from this world will be brought through. Yes, purified of dross, purified of what is bad. But there is so much that is good that has been created by human beings that will be carried, I think, as treasures into heaven because they are part of what we as human beings have created in this world. So we will take forward ourselves with these abilities. What we enjoy doing in the Lord's service, we will continue to enjoy doing. William will continue to enjoy his maths problems. And Julie will come in and say, how are you getting on with that prime numbers problem, William? And he'll say, I've done it. I've done it. And you know what? I've also finally cracked Fermat's last theorem. Now, if you don't know what Fermat's last theorem is, then Fermat's last theorem is one of the most complex mathematical problems in history. It baffled mathematicians for centuries, but it was finally solved a few years ago. So I'm sure William wouldn't mind me saying that I don't think he would get close to solving it now. But I think we will grow and we will expand in our learning and our abilities in heaven. The things we enjoy doing, we will do better and better and better. People say to me, well, you won't have any work in heaven because they'll be unemployed, the doctors, won't they? I say, yeah, I won't be a psychiatrist in heaven. There's no mental illness there. But I have transferable skills. I've been learning about people's behaviour and mental function and the relationship of the mind and the body. And I'll be able to explore that more and do more experiments and learn more of who we are and how the Lord has made us as human beings. I enjoy that. And Mike will continue to enjoy writing poetry. And he will write better and better poetry forever. More wonderful, more insightful, more enjoyable. All the skills, the knowledge we have, I think, will continue to develop and refine in heaven. And we will enjoy doing all this as we do now, but we will do it free of the weaknesses and the limitations. We will do it undistractedly to the praise and honour of God, set free from everything that hinders us in this world. So heaven then is then this place where we'll be worshipping God. It's a place then, the second image, where we will be serving God with our work and service. Thirdly, third image of heaven is, of course, of a feast. It's a common image of heaven, isn't it? The heavenly banquet, the great feast that is stored up for us. Again, Isaiah said there in the Old Testament on several occasions, but Isaiah 25, he says, on this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, a rich food full of marrow, of aged wine well refined. And he will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. And the Lord will wipe away all tears from all faces. We see the language that we've read in Revelation 21. But we read also then of this rich feast, a feast of well-aged wine and so on. And Jesus, of course, took this up several times, didn't he, in his teaching, when he spoke in Luke 12 of himself incredibly serving at a banquet. Luke 14, when he told that parable of the great banquet. Matthew was the same sort of parable of that wedding feast, that great wedding banquet in heaven. Now, when we read of these things, and when we read, like, that passage I said there in Revelation 21, the kings and so on, it's not like I heard David Bowie say of one of his songs. I read him being interviewed a few years ago. And the interviewer, she said to him, you know, she thought he was great and all of that. But then she said, but, you know, these lyrics here, I don't quite understand what they mean. And Bowie apparently smiled and said, well, actually, they don't mean anything. I just need a few words to put in to fill it out, to make it keep going in the song. And I thought, well, I've often thought that about some pop lyrics and so on. They don't mean anything. But it's not like that with these passages, is it? So we don't come and just say, well, we've got this nice picture of kings coming to heaven, and all it's meant to do is kind of conjure up warm, fluffy images for us. Or this picture of a heavenly banquet, and all it's meant to be is, it makes me feel good to think, oh, it'll be lovely in some just general, completely non-specific way. No, there will be real food and real drink. Remember, Jesus ate and drank in his resurrection body. And remember, at the Last Supper, he himself said that he was eating and drinking the food and the wine there for the last time until he ate that food and that wine again in the kingdom of God. Because the Lord's Supper itself is then an anticipation of that heavenly feast, isn't it? It looks forwards in its small and minimal way to the banquet in heaven that Jesus pictured, with real food and real drink. And I think full then of all sorts of wonderful food and drink, all sorts of aged wines, as the prophet Isaiah said. There'll be no teetotalers in heaven. We will all enjoy this rich variety of food and drink. We will go round for fellowship and enjoy meals together. I'll go round and I'll say, "What are you serving tonight, Junie? Is it Thai food?" "No, no, I think I'll try Mongolian this time." There'll be all sorts, a huge range of foods and drinks, because we've got all that mankind has enjoyed down the ages and all the wonderful new things that there will be in heaven to enjoy. There'll be an immense variety of experiences and pleasures beyond what we can wonder. And I'll be there enjoying this Mongolian food, and Esther will come in and she'll say, "Oh, I've got this fantastic Chardonnay, Alan. You really must have it. It's even better than the Chablis we enjoyed last time." Because it will be a place of wonderful food and drink, but it will be fellowship. Because of course, when we gather to eat and drink at our fellowship meals here in each other's homes, yes, we gather to enjoy the food and the drink, and we will do that in glory. But it's for meeting each other, isn't it? And learning from each other and of each other, and saying, "Have you heard that William solved Fermat's last theorem?" And rejoicing in such success, rejoicing in such new learning together, deepening in our love for one another. We will continue then to grow in grace together, in glory, as we serve each other in table fellowship and all sorts of other work and play situations. And this finally, I think, segues into the fourth image, which is the image of marriage. Because sometimes, of course, the feast is explicitly a wedding feast or a marriage feast, isn't it? But it also segues, I think, into this fourth image of marriage, because trying to think through, you know, it's the relationships, it's the deepening of our relationships. Now, Jesus, of course, says that there is no marriage in heaven. We'll be like the angels because there'll be no reproduction. There'll be no sexual aspects in heaven. But we will still know and love one another, including our husbands and wives of this world. And that those relationships will grow. Marriage relationships then are about intimacy and openness. They're about trust, confidence in one another. Some time ago, before Sean and I got married, a chap in the church we were worshiping at, I remember him saying to me, he said, "Oh, I've got such a blessed marriage. And you know, we've been married now for 30 years, and I love my wife now more than I did then." I remember thinking, "Oh, sounds a bit odd." But it's true. I love my wife now more than I did then, because we grow in our knowledge of each other. We're not static. We grow, we develop, we mature, and we feed off, we help sustain and grow one another in intimate, close marriage relationships. And that will be true. The point is, not it's anticipated in our limited and still failing way in human marriage here. It'll be true in all sorts of relationships in heaven. I don't think we will love and know each other equally. Jesus, remember, he had closer relationships, didn't he? John, we understand, would be the beloved disciple, and there was Peter and James and that slightly wider group, and then the disciples and so on, his apostles. So Jesus, and I think in heaven we will have closer relationships and not so close relationships, which will still be holy and good and enriching. But there'll be people whom we're especially close to, whom we're especially intimate and trusting with, whom we enjoy those meals with and socialise with and so on more and more. We will do so and we will grow together. But of course, the primary focus then on the marriage image is of being married to Jesus, our Saviour. Here on earth, we are, as it were, engaged to him. That's the language. It's the language of consummation, of bringing that to its fullness in heaven. We know him now, we love him now. We long, as I've read earlier from the Psalms and so on, to love him more, to draw nearer to him. Physically, yes, but personally, emotionally, deeper into our relationship with him. Marriage is pictured then for us, the image is most famously perhaps in Ephesians 5, then the marriage one, is of the whole church, isn't it? It's the church as a whole. Language is again going back to Genesis and how things were at the beginning. The real marriage is always to be Jesus and his people. Every human marriage, a little imitation of that, a little anticipation of that. But that heavenly final marriage then is, yes, somehow the whole church, but it's also of us individually. It's not just of us as a church. So in 1 Corinthians 6, Paul speaks of us being individually joined in marriage to Jesus Christ. We're in faith union with him, and therefore we're married to him, so that to go with a prostitute was to destroy in a special way that relationship. So we are married individually, corporately to Jesus. And that means then the sort of relationship that a marriage has, as I've been talking about, of closeness, of confidence, of total honesty and openness. And it means it in the most profound way, in the deepest way, ways that we will never be able to get our heads around, I guess, in this world. Again, I don't quite know how we distinguish between the humanity and the deity of Jesus as we relate to him in this way. But we will all be able to relate to him intimately. We will all love him as our husband, as his saved people. We will love him in that way. We will be there in the deepest, most content, most wonderful marriage that has never yet been. And that, I believe, also will grow and grow forever and ever. Because I think that's quite possible from the way that we grow throughout this world in our relationships with one another. There we have then four images within what I've proposed as a four structure of heaven itself. May the Lord encourage us to reflect on them, to see what is good and right, and to be encouraged then in his service.